Okay, we're studying in the book of 2 Corinthians. We're near enough to the beginning that you won't have missed a lot. Today, we're going to look at an overview of 2 Corinthians. So we're really not into the text yet, so you're on target if you just will come back and study with us. I read a story some years ago about thieves who stole or tried to steal a brick garage, but in the process of stealing it, it fell in on them. You know what the problem was? They started removing the bricks from the bottom first, and it came to a point where it finally just fell in on them. Now we think, well, anybody, any idiot would know better than to do that. Well, they aren't any smarter than the person who went in the bank to rob the bank, and he had written his note, "Give me all the money in your cash box." He had written on the back of his deposit slip with his name and address and account number. And that's not any smarter than the robber came in and with a gun and said, "Give me all your cash." He said, "I don't have any cash. Will a check be all right? And how shall I make out the check?" And the man told him his name. That's plain dumb. But that's no worse than what we've often tried to do in the church to promote spreading the fragrance of the knowledge of Him everywhere from the outside in. And it just won't work. The whole building of that program will fall in on you if you do. And what the Spirit does in this handbook, if you'll turn to 2 Corinthians, and I want you to this morning to mark it. We're going to be doing a lot of reference to the text. I want you to put brackets around 2:14 and then turn to 6:1, 2:14, and then all the way through 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. It's not really all that much text. But at 6:1, put another bracket after 6:1. So that's what we're going to be looking at as the core of 2 Corinthians. What we're going to be doing in this study, I truly believe, will be life transforming. 2 Corinthians, for much of my life, a third of my life, meant absolutely nothing to me. It made no sense whatsoever. I remember asking the Lord, why did you include this in the text? Why did you include this letter in the canon? It makes no sense. And then a little fellow named Rex Bunt in New Zealand, Christ Church, New Zealand, who wore clothes that looked like a family had moved out and left him in there by himself. And he talked through his nose. He was epileptic. And yet he had a gift, and that's all I can call it, is a gift from God for reading, which made him dangerous. The last time he read was at a men's retreat, and I had worked for literally weeks trying to figure out what was the last thing I could say to this church that would be meaningful. And I looked out, and Rex Bunt was getting up to read. And he read out of 2 Corinthians. And that book that had been so beyond understanding, he cracked the door just enough that out of it came the study. Out of it came the book, The Aroma of Christ, 2 Corinthians. So that's where we are today. What we're going to be doing this morning is kind of giving an overview. We're going to put it in the form of a tent. Let's kind of dissect this chapter 2:14. Through 6:1, like this. First of all, the context of the divine power is not human power. The context of it is human weakness. Now, I know that contradicts everything probably that you could think of. You mean the context of divine power is human weakness? Well, it's more than that, really. That's not quite correct. The context of divine power is our awareness of human weakness. You may be humanly weak, But if you're not aware of it and are resigned to that and are okay with that and recognize, okay, I won't ask again. That's what Paul had to do when he had this thorn in the flesh, whether it was his eyes or his speech or whatever it was. He asked the Lord, please take this weakness away from me. And he was denied his request how many times? 3 times he asked. Finally, the Lord said, Paul, my grace is sufficient for you because, quote with me, my power is made perfect in weakness. No wonder the book didn't make any sense to me. That doesn't make sense. No, not if you're approaching it from a human standpoint. But if you're looking at it through divine eyes, if you look at it through the eyes of God, your power to do God's business is going to be rooted, it's going to have in it, as its context, your own awareness of how weak you are. And that smacks, that people don't like that. They don't like to hear it. Paul didn't like to hear it. Much of the book depends on and is given over to so many places where Paul talks about how weak he was and how incompetent he was, and that his competency for this new ministry, he said, it's not from me. This power is not mine. It's from God. And my competency comes through my awareness of my weakness. Our competence is in God. Finally, Paul said, okay, I will all the more then glory in my weakness, because when I am weak, then I'm strong. Now, does that make any sense to you? Can you grasp that? That he can take your weakness and use it as your strength. And think about what he says is the only real door into the human heart, the only real door into the world, the only real door into inheriting the earth. Which one of the Beatitudes addresses this specifically? Blessed are the meek. Now, he didn't say blessed are the weak, but when you look at the concept of meekness, it's this same similar thing. It's power under control, but it's, in a sense, it's power under the way God uses power. You know, the best door into another person's heart is to just surrender yourself to that person. It's difficult to resist someone who just simply demonstrates, okay, I'm not going to fight you. Okay, that's enough of that. But the context is human weakness. Now, there are 2 tent poles holding up this tent. You see the 2 poles holding up the tent. 2:15 tells us the what that we're talking about or the who. Someone, would you read 2:14 and 15, if you would? Tyler, read that good and loud for us.
Thanks be to God, who in Christ always leaves us in triumphal perfection, and through us spreads in every place the fragrance that comes from knowing him. For we are the aroma of Christ to God, among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing.
All right. For we are the aroma of Christ for God. If there is a preposition there, should be translated, we are for God, the aroma of Christ. It's not that we are to God, but we are God's aroma for the world, the aroma of Christ. That we represent God among the world. We smell like Christ to the world. And it may be, of course, to God too, but the context and all says we are God's representatives on earth to smell like Christ. To some it smells like death, to others it smells like life, but we are God's aroma. So that's what we're talking about today, or in this study. That's what we're talking about, is we are the aroma of Christ. We're to smell like him. We are to represent him. We're to stand in for him. We are to be his ambassadors. When last time we talked about it, we talked about the difference between a disciple and an ambassador. What is the difference, Chang, between being a disciple and being an ambassador? You weren't here, so you'll be fresh on it. What's the difference between being a disciple and an ambassador? All right, and the disciple, so which one comes first? The disciple is a learner. The ambassador is a representative who goes out after having learned. That's what we're wanting to be. Do you want to be an ambassador for Christ? Or have you thought about it? Have you thought about your ministry? That your life is your ministry. How many of you are full-time ministers? You're catching it slowly. There you go. You're a full-time minister. I want to ask you again and see if we can't get everybody. How many of you are full-time ministers? Well, great, because your life is your ministry. Now listen, if you ever get those two separated, you've missed the whole point of Christianity. You've missed the whole point. Okay. He said everybody that raised their hand be at the jail at 8 o'clock what time? Tonight, okay. Now listen, if that's the case, that's it. Then ministry becomes nothing more than living out what has been put in by God into your heart. That's exciting. So what it says is we're all full-time ambassadors for Christ, for we are the aroma of Christ. That ought to not scare us. That ought to make things kind of simple. And he later on talks about the thing that's so amazing is that this treasure has been put in mud buckets. Look at you. We're just mud buckets. You mean he uses us? Oh, yeah. He doesn't have anything else to use except cracked jars. That's all he's got. If he could find a well-shaped, totally perfect, uncracked jar, he would probably use it. But the problem is he can't find one like that. We're all cracked jars. Are you okay with that? That's part of your weakness. If you're sitting here thinking that you've got it all together, you're about as useless as you could possibly be to God. And I tell you what's true individually is all true, also true corporately. Any group of people that think they've got it all together, they're about as useless to God as they could possibly be. Congregationally, any congregation that thinks they've got all the answers, you're no use to God. Any movement, if you let me expand that, any movement that thinks they've got it all right, they don't have a beginning. They don't have a clue as to what God is going to be using for his purposes. Okay, so the who or the what, we are the aroma of Christ. That's one of the poles that underline 2:15. Underline that. And then underline 3:18. That's the how. How do we become the aroma of Christ? Well, in 3:18 he says, and I'm going to read it out of the RSV or quote it out of the RSV. This is the NIV. The NIV misses the point. I'm sorry to say they missed the point. We all with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being changed into his likeness from one degree of glory to another. This comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. So the what is we are the aroma of Christ. How do we become the aroma? You become it by beholding the glory of the Lord. And in so doing, you transform yourself into his likeness or not? This isn't something that you do. Now you do decide whether you're going to behold his glory. That's a decision that you make. And everybody has to make that decision. You're going to have to make the decision as to whether or not you behold his glory, that you gape at it, that you gaze at it, that you worship it. The glory of the Lord that we're talking about that transforms you into his likeness, it won't be looking at the beauty of the nature around us, the leaves and the sun and the moon. That's the glory is there too. But the glory that we are to behold that changes us into his likeness is found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's where it's found. John says that we beheld His glory. Glory is of the only begotten Son of the Father. And that He has explained God to us. He has exegeted God to us. And it's in His life that the gospel records record. It's in that life that you find the glory of the Lord revealed. The gospel records, I am convinced, are so God-breathed that they actually find themselves standing there radiating radioactivity. I believe that. I have experienced that. And you have too, if you have read them with insight and have read them faithfully. That's where it comes from. What about Acts and the letters? They reflect upon the glory that's revealed in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's what their task is. But they are a result of what is written in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Actually, the letters were written first because the glory that's revealed in Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, the glory that's revealed there in writing was for the first 20 or so years was simply mouth to mouth or mouth to ear. And people, they recounted and told their experience with the Lord Jesus. And that's all they had. They just had this audible record. And then churches were formed when they heard about Him. And then letters needed to be written to correct the problems that were in those churches. And then finally, they began to say, you know, this needs to be put down in writing. And so chronologically, the Gospels came after the letters, but when you read all of them together, if you don't read the Gospels first and let them sink into you, all you're going to be doing is reading what is supposed to come as a result of those, and you're going to be looking at the results rather than the cause. And as a result, you're going to be finding what you're supposed to be doing before you've discovered the power to do it. Now, is this making any sense to you at all? If it doesn't, I'm going to start over in just a minute, and we'll just do it again. Because this is so vital. We've got to understand that the how, we are with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord. Your NIV says, reflecting the glory of the Lord. But that makes no sense because so the figure he's using is that you're going to become like what you gaze at. Now, if you put a reflect upon, that's all right. And in the footnote of the NIV, it says contemplate. We all, with unveiled face, contemplating the glory of the Lord, are being changed into His likeness. That's all. That'll work. And the reason why it'll work is that you're always going to become like what you worship. You're going to become like what you gaze at. You're going to become like what you contemplate on. Count on it. You're not going to be the first one to escape the natural consequences of becoming like what you worship. You'll not be the first exception. If you contemplate on something that's vulgar and gross all week long and then come here on Sunday morning, this isn't going to get it if that's the way you live your life. Because remember, your life is your ministry. Your ministry is your life. And you're going to become like what you worship. It has never failed yet. You will not be the first exception. And if you're not caught by the majesty of Jesus of Nazareth, if you're not caught, if you're not hooked, if you have not become addicted to Jesus of Nazareth, you will be addicted to something. We are addicts. Every last one of us is an addict to something. It'll be money or sex or work or television or whatever it is. Unless you become addicted to Jesus Christ, something else is going to get you. So this is something here, the who and the how. Those two poles hold up this whole ministry. The four tent pegs are being, having, knowing, and working, and they come in that order. It's not visible in the English language. It doesn't jump out at you. But in the Greek text, it actually jumps out at you. These sections are controlled by these very words. In chapter 2:14 through the end of that chapter 3, 2:14 through 3:18 addresses the subject of being. And that verb being is in different forms. Some of them are passive, some are active, some are assumed and are not there because they're so obvious that they don't have to have a verb. But they are controlled by the to be verb. Then the next one, chapter 4, is controlled by the verb have. We have this ministry. We don't lose heart. Verse 7, we have this treasure in jars of clay. Every paragraph is dominated by that verb to have. First of all, being, but then the next section is having, and it talks about what we have, the blessings we have. Being, having, and that's chapter 4. And then chapter 5 is dominated by the verb knowing. Look at verse 1. Now we know. Look at verse 6. Therefore we're always confident and we know. Look at verse 11. Since then we know what it is to fear the Lord. And then verse 16. From now on we regard. But that's the same Greek verb as is we know nobody from a human point of view. Being and having and knowing, those are the predecessors. They precede this final one in 6:1, the verb there, working, or fellow workers. Good grief, you mean all that goes before you do anything? Well, you'd better get started before you do anything. I want to read something. And the reason why I'm reading this, this is today's Oswald Chambers. It's this morning. I got up this morning, and guess what the topic for this morning was? The transformed life. The transfigured life, he calls it. Listen to this. If any man, he's quoting out of 2 Corinthians 5:17. If any man is in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. What idea have you of the salvation of your soul? The experience of salvation means that in your actual life, things are really altered. You no longer look at things as you used to. Your desires are new. Old things have lost their power. One of the touchstones of experience is, has God altered the thing that matters? If you still hanker after the old things, it is absurd to talk about being born from above. You're juggling with yourself. If you're born again, the Spirit of God makes the alteration manifest in your actual life and reasoning, and when the crisis comes, you are the most amazed person on earth at the wonderful difference there is in you.